All right. I think, Tyler, we can start. Thanks for joining me.
It's a pleasure.
In this pod. I guess it's a little bit rebranding. So thanks for coming.
Happy to be here. Giving me a place to stay for the weekend. We're kicking it in Munich.
Yeah. And yeah, just I guess bringing in more personal conversation into politics. And let's see where it goes. I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't really get a script or really structure. So I don't even know what he means when he says personal. But yeah. We're gonna see.
Yeah. I wanted to ask, because I think it's like the question that, you know, when you study politics, there is obviously some kind of reason behind. Have you thought about your reason why you study politics?
Why I study politics? I guess I always saw politics as something that has a direct impact on my life and the lives of others. I think especially just thinking about, you know, the history of racial discrimination in the U.S.
Right.
and so on and so forth. I mean, I think about, you know, my grandfather was told to me from a very, very young age. He was the first black director at RCA. I'm not sure if you heard of the company. I don't even know. I don't even think it exists anymore. But at the time, it's very well known. It was a big electronics company. And yeah, he was the first black director, but he found out that he could have been vice president, but one of his coworkers told him, you know, the people upstairs, they're prejudiced, you don't have a chance. Yeah. Otherwise you probably would be, but I guess this guy had some sort of connects with the higher, so kind of had some insight into their thinking. So, you know, it's just, and I suppose it's not a in itself a political decision, but, you know, just the idea that, okay, you know, some people are considered more American than others.
Right.
You know, and so on. And of course, you know, you learn about the history of the civil rights movement, things like that. So that kind of always made me attuned to politics. And then outside the other thing would probably be music, rap music specifically. I mean, growing up, it was always in the house. My dad put me onto what he was listening to. And of course, not all, but a good amount of the music he put me onto. I mean, he put me onto all kinds of music, but talking about rap, this is a lot of was overtly political, you know. So that's from when I'm 7, 8, 9, 10, like. That's in the background. You just mess with the music, but you're also listening to what they're saying.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that's some of the origins.
That's an interesting way to get into politics, by listening to music.
Yeah, you think like Public Enemy. You know, even Wu-Tang's got some, you know, people kind of think of them as just straight thuggish, but
yeah,
they had very cerebral lines, and they're talking about, you know, just life in America, and they're coming out of the ghetto and so on, so... You know, but Public Enemy was very overt, you know, plenty of other, Tupac as well.
Right.
Yeah, so.
Kind of addressing, kind of use Pyre to address.
Like problems.
Of society. Yeah, just the awareness. Because, you know, for me, it's like I grew up in the suburbs, right? And I went through racism still. I mean, plenty of racism since I could account. But, you know, I didn't grow up in the ghetto. You know what I'm saying? Like I, materially, financially, I had a privileged upbringing. But, you know, you hear these people talking from the other side of America. And breaking it down and all this in this ways.
Yeah. I see. That's pretty interesting. Have you thought about what's your like ultimate ambition? In relation to politics,
I do think it would probably be working in academia, being a professor. Like if we're talking dream scenario. You know, as I've talked about the subject with you before, maybe working in research as well in regard to, you know, maybe something related to migration. It's a very relevant topic right now and so on. Growing up, I never wanted to get directly into politics as a politician because I feel like, you know, it's such a dirty game that to play the game, you got to get tainted. But then, I mean, honestly, I'm not going to lie, and I'm just kind of thinking out loud right now, but as I'm getting older, you know, I'm an adult now, I'm 24, you know, and we're living through this, these things do impact our everyday lives, politics, and so on and so forth, and I'm very dissatisfied with what I see in the world, and especially in my country. I do think, like, put my money where my mouth is and get right into it, you know, that would be social organizing. That doesn't necessarily mean running for office, but, so yeah, I guess I got a couple things.
Right.
Just trying to figure it out. Let me go see.
It's better not to close yourself. For opportunities and stuff.
Yeah. Try to be open-minded. So, yeah. And yourself? Yeah, why'd you get into politics? I'll throw it back at you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we discussed it personally a couple of times. For me, I mean, the moment was that I wanted to become a diplomat. I mean, since like very, very young age. I remember, you know, like when I was a kid, I had like a toys and I assigned them roles, like a cabinet, and just like played with like the idea of like achieving something like from negotiation perspective. I've always been fascinated by this concept that like really the concept of diplomacy And still, like, it's from the old research interest, like thinking about diplomacy, like through diplomacy, is really interesting for me. It's especially interesting now, given the events. And I think you can attest to the fact that diplomacy is kind of broken. It's not something that people evoke when they think about solving problems in international relations. And, you know, we can get into why is that. I mean, I have my own thoughts. But this is how I got into politics. So I went to the GIMO, which is like the School for Future Diplomats in Russia. And, you know, I unfortunately couldn't, you know, finish it properly in a way, because I had a lot of internal conflicts with the system, because it's basically, you know, this system puts you into kind of this position of just following the rules without questioning like basic assumptions, basic principles. So it just trains you to be this kind of like cog in a bigger machine, a mechanism. Mm. And of course I wanted to go into university as a place as you envision in the US, something about exploring your own interests, exploring your own preferences and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. I mean, I kind of like the life hit me hard in this sense, because I mean, it was obviously a little bit naive, but like, who is not naive when you're like 17 or 18?
Yeah.
Makes sense. And then I moved to Germany, and you know, I think I hid for a moment for a long period of time. I'm gonna hit this I would say the desire to work in this direction, but now I definitely do not close myself for the opportunity, not necessarily to be like a diplomat as a person who is assigned like this role, but to think through diplomacy and trying to like bring my knowledge and my understanding to the solution of the conflicts, especially the conflict between the West and Russia. So for me, I view it as my mission. I don't know, because I definitely understand both perspectives really well. So my ultimate goal, and I mean, I mean, we talked like many times personally, is like to kind of like build the bridge, I would say, between Russia and the US or the West, Europe in particular. And because I definitely see the future of Russia as part of the European continent, I think it's the only logical, reasonable solution to the problems, like both European problems and Russian problems. So it's just the way to get there. This is like unknown, so to speak. This is like what we are living through. And I think there is a lot of, I mean, we discussed it as well. There is a lot of just violence and turbulence because people haven't found the way to kind of like correctly fit Russia into this broader European or Western kind of narrative. So that's in a nutshell my story.
I see. And so how much did political events in your upbringing shape your mindset towards Russia's relationship with the West? Because, I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, the protests in 2012, right? When Putin comes back into the highest office after Medvedev steps down. You know, did that... I mean, I guess you were already in the politics by then, but I just... Right.
Yeah, I was interested since early ages. So, of course, like political events in Russia were like of deep interest to me. Of course, I grew up, I remember like Medvedev time. I grew up with, when I was a teenager, basically like 17, 18, I grew up with the protests in Russia. And of course, and all those things definitely shaped my perception. Mm-hmm. And of course, like deep down, from a value perspective, I definitely value individualism and liberty. And of course, that's also, this has also drove the conflict in me with the kind of like the Russian system. And that's the reason I moved also ultimately, because, you know, the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs is basically a representation of a Russian state. And it functions the way it functions for, I mean, obvious reason, because it has to fulfill like this specific role. This is how it shaped. And for me, for example, the fascination with the West was something the opposite. So, of course, I got very religiously pro-American, you know, got very religiously liberal to the point when, I guess, before I moved, I mean, when I moved to Germany, so 2018, 2019, I was like deeply liberal. So you would definitely hear me defending not a CNN type of bullet points, but it would be very close in terms of how I thought about the world. And then, of course, for me, everything shattered when you just, the more you live here, the more you notice that like certain patterns, they are basically the same, the same in Russia and the West. So the difference is more of an imaginary, so to speak. So this is how my kind of like my process of thinking evolved. So it became more critical of the West itself, so to speak, because of a lot of hypocrisy.
Once you actually came to live in it.
Right, because when you see it as a dream, you kind of envision it as a place where the problems that you experience in Russia, one can say they're irrelevant. Or it's like, you know, but then you find out that it's all about, there is just like a narrative. And both in Russia and the West, they really protect their own narrative. And they really do not allow, I mean, certain type of, I would say, exploration of certain ideas that is beyond this narrative. Of course, you won't go to jail as easily. I mean, even though I wouldn't say so now, because, you know, there are like a lot of stuff going on in Germany and throughout Europe, just because of the people who are in opposition to the current system. And of course, the system, you know, the system involves.
Yeah, especially when you talk about Palestine and Israel. I mean, we're seeing a lot of crackdown on freedom of expression on that, which is, you know, it's a slippery slope. You know, I think some people don't fully grasp, you know, or maybe they have a pro-Israel viewpoint. And they think, oh, it'll whatever. I don't like these people anyway. So screw them. But they don't understand that you might be next.
Yeah, you
might be next.
You go against fundamental values. And then, of course, you start thinking about just in general what the West sort of stands for and what are Western values. And again, how Russia relates to that in a broader context and broader sense, at least for me. And right now, I mean, my perspective is definitely evolving. I don't really have like a firm standpoint. Except for the fact that, as I told you, I really value, obviously, individual freedom, self-expression. But then, it's hard for me to reconcile it with the fact that there is a lot of hypocrisy in the West itself regarding those values and regarding those ideals, so to speak. And then, of course, I guess, to me, it just comes to the practical issue that I just believe that the future, like Russian future in Europe, in the West, is just beneficial for both like Russia and the West itself. So this is kind of my thinking around this process, which is, you know, kind of evolving, and let's see where it leads.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, Europe and Russia, I mean, when's the last time they've been this far apart? I mean, I guess during the Cold War, Western Europe obviously was very far from Russia. But I mean, at least Eastern Europe, I mean, well, then also we're talking, it was under pressure.
Right.
Tied with the Soviet Union. But yeah, in terms of the gap between the two right now,
I'm not sure
the last time it's been.
I guess I would ask you, again, the question that we discussed yesterday, right? This idea that, like, do you believe in the fact that, I mean, the U.S. and maybe, I mean, now it's, of course, different with Trump because everything can change rapidly. But there is a certain, suspicion that in general, the West is just not interested in Russia kind of succeeding in any form or way for some reason. And I don't know. I mean, of course, it sounds like very conspiratorial. It sounds something like, you know, you would hear from Putin propaganda. But to a certain extent, I feel there is a truth in that for some reason they have like a deep-seated just suspicion, you know, regarding Russia as a country.
I mean, I think you first off, you have to start out and define what do you exactly mean by the West? Because to me, I mean, for Europe, I think they were not particularly anti-Russia at all. I mean, again, this is something I've said to you before off a podcast. You know, Germany wants the cheap gas for their exports from Russia. I mean, they have a strong incentive in having a relationship with Russia. And, you know, you probably are aware that for a long time the U.S. is warning Germany, oh, do you really want to be so reliant on their energy? Because if such and such goes wrong, you know, you're going to be left footing the bill. But Germany and maybe parts of the West in general, not maybe Eastern Europe, but parts of Europe, let's just keep it to Germany, they felt that, okay, over time, Russia will continuously develop their economy and they'll become more liberal and someone like Putin won't be in the fold anymore and everything will be okay. And I think that was the convenient thing for them to believe. Because if you follow this belief, then it's not problematic that you're buying all this Russian gas. Because obviously, I mean, until they stopped buying it, they were funding the Russian war machine. Right. And then France, you know, I think Russia would have been useful for their idea of strategic autonomy, you know, bring another military power. For the U.S., I don't think it was necessarily they wanted Russia to fail, to not be able to prosper in any sense. But I definitely think, you know, they wanted to keep their influence in certain areas like Ukraine, for example. And I mean, from our conversations, you very well will disagree, but when we talk about Ukraine, I do think it is U.S. imperial influence that we're talking about when we talk about all the support that the U.S. has given to Ukraine and so on. But to put it bluntly, I think this is a case of benign imperial influence.
But can there be something as a benign imperial influence? Because I guess we can maybe like take a step back and think about what is an empire? Because I mean, empire, I think eventually it's all about serving interests not of the people who live in Ukraine, but actually of the people who have no real connection to the land. I mean, so it's always about fulfilling interests of people somewhere there.
Empire imposes its will on another region, whether that be through economic force, material force, or maybe even soft power.
Right.
You know, but I mean, the reason I say this is a case of benign imperial interference, because I mean, of course, Ukraine is very far from the U.S. It's there's no natural inclination between the U.S. and Ukraine. But the reality is that the U.S. is helping Ukraine keep its independence as a country.
Right.
Because if Putin is to succeed in his goals, the Ukraine will no longer be independent. So, I mean, going back to your original question, does the U.S. want Russia to fail in general? No, I don't believe that. But I think they don't want Russia to undermine the rules-based world order that, you know, everyone's been talking about, especially in the light of the fact that it really looks like it might be dead. It's on life support is what it looks like. And Russia is actively seeking to undermine that. And they very well may succeed. But in a hypothetical where, you know, Russia is not invading other countries in Europe or in general, I don't think there's any sort of inherent antagonism effort to dismantle Russia. That's not how I see it. But I think it's totally possible for Russia to integrate in the West. But again, in the terms of this conflict at the moment, it's not feasible. But we, you know, with the political headwinds that we see taking place, you know, if more Russia-friendly parties take power in Europe, you know, if the AfD is able to take power, I mean, that would be a massive flip. That's the strongest economy. I mean, right now, we're looking there. They're 23% in polls. The CDU, who is now obviously their member of their party's chancellor, Friedrich Merz, are at 27.
Right.
So obviously, there's plenty of time between the next election. I believe that'd be 2028, most likely. But, I mean, a lot of things look... they look fluid. Things are very unpredictable.
That's true. But like for me, for example, what I'll try to explain my thinking, which I guess like just fundamental for ideas I promote, is like I feel the war in Ukraine, at least from some deep, let's say, strategic calculation, it is about, I mean, again, integrating Russia into the West. Because and the way I think about it, like Russia... pre 2020, like a full scale invasion, what people call in the West. Pre invasion, I mean, Russia had basically very bleak chances as a country. I mean, it was already heavily sanctioned. It was already basically excluded from Western, at least access, like full access to Western economies. There were no prospects to solve the problem because they would never solve the Crimea issue. They would just never agree. And I mean, of course, Russia like developed as a kind of like a develop its relations with China for 20 years as a safe place to go, like in case the, you know, relations with the West go really bad. And like, for me, trajectory of Russian system, of Russian economy was very bleak. So, you know, it was probably the moment when the Putin started the war in Ukraine, it was the moment either Russia inserts its will now or probably never, so to speak. And for me, for example, how I think about it from a strategic perspective, but it's like, what is at stake, like, fundamentally here? Because, I mean, its stake is not, of course, Ukrainian sovereignty. I agree with you that they are not interested in, like, you know, having Ukraine as a sovereign country. But, like, at stake, I think it's something bigger, so to speak, you know, something fundamentally how Russia can succeed in the future. And if you think, like, the only way they can solve the problem is probably by, again, inserting its own will on Europe.
I think that may be true only from the perspective of it's either Putin or nothing. Because, I mean, as again I've told you before, repeating on the podcast, I think Putin may well have been right in his personal assessment that an independent Ukraine is a threat to my regime. I can't allow it. But again, that's on the condition that we need to accept Putin. And I mean, look, if you're a Russian living in Russia, you know, I'm not going to sit here and from, you know, Munich and lecture about how you need to overthrow the government. You know, that's obviously way easier said than done. Mm. But from perspective of Europe or the US, I mean, it's simply unacceptable because of all the ripple effects, you know, of what this means for international relations as well. Mm. You could maybe say we already entered a new historical period. Maybe you could even argue that the post 1945 world order was already dead, and that's why Putin was able to do what he did.
I will just disagree strongly, because I think we live, I mean, fundamentally before 2020, I mean, before the invasion, we lived in a post-Cold War order, because it was different. You know, you cannot really say that we lived in a post-World War II order, because the order also evolved and changed after the end of the Cold War.
It did. I guess to be more specific, I'm talking about specific continuities between the post-1945 mm-hmm. and the post-Cold War order, which one of them means you can't just invade nations and take them over.
But here, like for example, how it breaks down, because the US was like the first country that did it, right? I mean, with Iraq and Kosovo, basically the first country that basically said, well, we have a will, we have a strong interest and will, and we're going to enforce our will here, right? Mm. And I mean, of course, and then I know, like, the slippery slope when I say so, because it definitely sounds like Russian propaganda, right? In a way, that's
what you're saying isn't false. It's there is severe hypocrisy. You could even argue that more often than not, if you look at the history, the U.S. has been more often than not, the U.S. has been hypocritical in how it's applied international law than when it has been consistent. Mm-hmm. But as I said before, I think the ideal solution is to try to hold everybody accountable to these rules. And, you know, that's a responsibility for Americans in particular. I mean, plenty of people protested when that war happened. Obviously, it happened anyway. And you had I don't even know how long occupation, almost 20 years. It happened. But I don't think the solution is to go back to an era of spheres of influence, you know, overtly. And I mean, an age of overt empires. I think as a human being and how I would like to see the world, ideally, it's a worse world for everybody else. Mm. And I mean, I get, you know, it's okay when you do it, it's fine. And when we do it, it's not. The hypocrisy is there. But I guess I would ideally strengthen international institutions like the UN and so forth. But, you know, the U.S. is the most powerful country. So if the U.S. isn't fully on board, then already. And then the way the Security Council functions, one person veto. So, but I think, and, you know, it is interesting because, you know, maybe it's almost like we're having like an obituary for, and you want to call it the post-Cold War order, post-1945, but having an obituary for it, because what I think theoretically, in principle, they were trying, some individuals, these individuals were trying to achieve with the UN and so on, I really think is admirable. Even with all its innate hierarchies, you know, the fact that there is no African nation on the Security Council, you know, and so on, which ideally maybe would reform, but what we seem to be heading towards is something that I'm very concerned about.
Well, I guess it also kind of leads us in the direction of just talking about diplomacy, because as you said before, I mean, the UN is dysfunctional for a reason. And not only UN, I mean, like, bilateral relations between Russia and the US and the West, I mean, they are pretty dysfunctional, man. It's like those two, I mean, entities, like nations, they cannot even agree on some really basic, I mean, of course, there is some basic, you know, understanding of like the interaction, maybe because of nuclear weapons, but they really cannot kind of like sit down and listen to each other's perspectives and agree on a maybe new, I mean, you can say world order, but at least agree on some set of rules that will guarantee the peace and stability. Because otherwise, of course, we already have a war. And when the war started, for me, for example, the biggest question I argued is like the common denominator is like, okay, how can we have this war and avoid like a bigger war, for example, right? I mean, because the bigger war would be, you know, devastating for everyone. This is for me like the question is like, why? I mean, because I think it is a valid question to ask, like, why does diplomacy, why diplomacy fails times and times again in modern world? And, you know, you can give a lot of answers to that.
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking about specifically the case of Russia and why, you know, a solution wasn't found before an invasion took place, yeah, I mean, go down the rabbit hole with that. I mean, I think some people point to the fact that Obama didn't follow through on his red line statement in Syria. Chemical weapons are used, mm-hmm. will respond, then he didn't. And some people think, okay, maybe that's something to do with Putin feeling bold enough to take Crimea.
But you see that here, I mean, it's again, it's more like this thinking, like it's thinking through, thinking about diplomacy through deterrence, which is a way of how West, I think, thinks about diplomacy. But this is, not, I mean, for me, this is not diplomacy that what should be about, because diplomacy is fundamentally about coming to the table, listening to another perspective, and then trying to, I go from there, because you can, I mean, you can really ignore another person's perspective, opinion, until you know the person is just like he will just say, oh fuck you.
Well, I think Putin, I think when you're talking about Putin, I think he only understands force on a certain level. I mean, you had diplomacy, you had, you know, peace treaties or ceasefires after the conflict in Donbass in eastern Ukraine that was going on since, what, 2014, roughly. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's the Budapest Memorandum, but, I mean, Putin wasn't there to sign that, but he should be still obligated to that, but he didn't sign it. But if we're talking about things that Putin specifically did, you had agreements, but at a certain point, obviously, he felt that wasn't enough for him. And it's... the thing is, you know, Ukraine's territorial sovereignty should not be negotiable, should not be negotiable, in my view. Mm-hmm. And... you know, and that's what the world order is tilting on right now because of the precedent that would set.
But how do you think about like just like the raw facts on like what they call on the ground? Like it's already not there. You know?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously he's occupied. I mean, right now Russia occupies what 20-30% of Ukraine, and obviously, I mean, Crimea is not going to get taken back. So. I mean, I think Ukraine seems to understand that they're not going to be able to take that land back anytime soon. Mm-hmm. It seems like Zelensky, from what I read at least, that he doesn't want to officially acknowledge that that's Russian land. But in de facto, he understands mm-hmm. they can't take it back. So Russia will have that. But then we come to security guarantees. And, you know, they don't want Ukraine to join NATO. I mean, that was even the case under Biden. He wouldn't say it out loud, but that was the case under Biden. Mm-hmm. The Europeans aren't in the position to send enough peacekeeping troops there, I think, to really deter Putin. Right. So it's, you know, Putin seems to really insist on wanting Zelensky out of power one way or another. Right. And it's, yeah, I mean, neither of the two sides seem willing to give up at the moment. So it's...
Well, I mean, it is a struggle of will. It's like how I fundamentally, like politics, especially on this level, it is fundamentally like a struggle of like two wills. It's like who can enforce his will. I mean, his or her will, doesn't really matter in this context. And of course, you know, I mean, fundamentally, it is about, you know, how it's like, and it is fundamentally for me, it's like, why? It's like, I mean, of course, there's like, why doesn't Russia want Ukraine in NATO? And here again, why I'm thinking from the perspective that they cannot allow Ukraine to go to NATO, because for Russia, it means to lose Ukraine, but it also means to lose access to the West itself. Because without Ukraine, like with Ukraine and NATO, I mean, Russia has nothing to do with the West anymore, basically. You know what I mean? It's like, because it's literally like two separate entities forever.
Yeah, but I guess I don't see why Ukraine joining NATO hypothetically at some point, or the EU, would permanently shut Russia out. I mean, look, as long as Russia is an autocracy, I mean, for all the West's hypocrisy, I mean, we can take this conversation a whole other dialogue in terms of if we want to go into detail about the hypocrisy of the West, and not just with the war in Gaza, everything that's been happening before then regarding how they treat certain citizens. But I mean, the thing is, I mean, Russia's just not in any condition to meet EU requirements in terms of governments. Not to say that couldn't change. But again, now we're talking about it's on the condition that Putin stays in power, because Putin is not interested in losing power anytime.
I mean, of course, you know, of course, Russia is an autocracy with, you can say, with the faces of dictatorship right now. I mean, it is just basic fact. However, I also think that if West ever had a desire to really get Russia into NATO, they would have done it. Because, I mean, there were examples in history when they accepted pretty authoritarian nations in NATO.
Mm-hmm. But I think that, I guess they felt, though, that their interests, even if these people were... Because speaking about NATO and speaking about EU is a little different, as far as my understanding. I mean, I'm not familiar with all...
Like, for example, from this question, there have never been a country that was accepted first to EU. So all the countries that are in EU were accepted first to NATO.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of an interesting also fact that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it is very close entity, so to speak.
Every country that was accepted in the EU was accepted into NATO first.
Yeah, correct.
Okay.
So, I mean, this is, of course, a very intertwined issue. And, of course, from my perspective, the way it is going to develop, once they settle the question of NATO, like the next step will be the question of EU. And Russia will probably say, and this is how the conflict started, right? In 2014, when Russia was afraid again to lose Ukraine to EU from perspective of a free trade agreement, right?
Yeah. It was step towards EU.
So again,
step towards EU membership.
Right. So again, from my perspective, what Russia is going to do is going to take like the hostage, Ukraine as a hostage, and say, okay, You want Ukraine in EU, you can only do it with Russia. Because if Russia wants something from the EU, it's access to European market. Because for Russia, it is an immense growth, economically.
Yeah, I don't disagree that that's probably plays a factor in how he sees it. And I mean, with you know, the Trump administration, it seems like Trump is trending the direction where, you know, instead of being like Biden, where until the war in Ukraine ends on a manner that we find sustainable, you are not reintegrating back into the West. But now Trump seems to take the attitude that the war is just one of many other issues on which the U.S. and Russia can have discussions. So, hey, preferably you stop this war, but at the same time, let's talk about, you know, nuclear proliferation,
right?
You know, your relationship with the West, you know, what he was asking, I believe Trump asked Putin if he wanted to be a mediator for negotiations with Iran.
Right.
Because now Trump is interested in joining the agreement that he himself unilaterally left during his first term. So it appears maybe he's starting to go things are going in the direction that Putin may like, and time will tell. It's still plenty of uncertainty, but yeah, it's certainly a very interesting time to be a follower of politics too.
I mean, definitely the historical moment. Okay, let's I guess take a break and come back. Okay, guys, we're back. It's really fascinating time to observe international relations and politics. And I guess we can kind of switch the topic, right? Maybe talk about the U.S. and maybe your thoughts on the current development. Again, recently, as you know, I don't follow the news super closely. It's also a lot.
It really is a lot. Sometimes you gotta take a break for your mental health, even right? If you study politics,
yeah. Yeah. So, I guess, like, what's your impression?
Well, like you said, it's a lot, but I think my overall impression is the U.S. seems to be actively playing a role in dismantling the world order that contributes to its own power. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think what we are seeing before our eyes is an empire in decline.
Right.
You know, with the defunding of USAID, which, I mean, there was plenty, I think, definitely to criticize about that institution. But, I mean, a lot of people are going to suffer because of the, I would say, reckless cuts that have been made. And I think one of the biggest takeaways is that the U.S., seeing the U.S. as a reliable partner, I mean, it's not the case anymore. I mean, for Canada, for, I think, Europe in general, I mean, I think everyone's watching how we're acting. I mean, starting a trade war on our own ally.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, we're openly threatening Greenland.
Right.
With military force as well. Panama as well. So, it's sad to see, because, I mean, I do believe that we are absolutely stronger with Europe.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. Just, I mean, if you look at the EU as an economic bloc, I mean, it has more wealth than any other economic bloc in the world. I believe the EU as a trading zone as a whole actually contains more GDP. The GDP level is higher mm-hmm. than the US itself. So I don't understand this such a high level of antagonism. I mean, in these recent chats that we see that got leaked because I accidentally added the editor mm-hmm. of The Atlantic. I mean, you see Vance, you know, saying, I hate that we're bailing out Europe again, because talking about, you know, that passage near where the Houthis are attacking ships and so on, that a lot of it contributes to European trade. And he's like, why are we bailing these people out? I'm not exactly sure how true that statement was, but I mean, the freedom of navigation, that's in the U.S. interest too. I mean, we do massive amounts of trade, of course.
I mean, the U.S. provides freedom of navigation. That's kind of like a basic...
Yeah, it's part of the deal. You know, we provide freedom of navigation, and in return, a series of other nations help us out. Like, I mean, there's a reason that Australia sends soldiers when we go wherever. I mean, not to get into the moral reasons of why we're in such and such place. But there's a relationship that we had with a series of countries, and... I find it to be very self-destructive. But you know what's interesting, and I got to give a shout out to an academic. I believe his name is Jason Blakely. Jason Blakely. He had a great book called "Lost in Ideology," talking about political ideologies. But the one thing I'm referencing in particular, his opinion on why the U.S. is so antagonistic with Europe, is he says that they have kind of a view of the world that it's a survival of the fittest, social Darwinism, ultranationalism, mm-hmm. doesn't believe in multilateralism, these international institutions, which reflects, I think, Trump's behavior. They pulled out of the World Health Institute and so on. And what you see in the EU, even with all its flaws, which, again, we could have a whole conversation about that and their own hypocrisies, you do see a level of belief in multilateralism, obviously, between the member states and so on, going beyond nationalism. And they resent that. So the idea that it's on an ideological mm-hmm. basis, because again, from a strictly rational one, it doesn't make any sense. I think to criticize Europe for freeloading off U.S. defense, valid point. I mean, it's been made by multiple administrations for decades, I think going back to Reagan at least. But it goes back to also when we were saying about the war in Ukraine. I think the outcome is a much more uncertain and unsafe world.
Right. I mean, the way... I mean, I think you correctly described it as a decline of the American power, but I would definitely point out to the fact that it has been happening for a while. So I would be cautious to say whether this is the Trump contributing to more decline, or whether it's like Trump trying to actually reformulate American role in the world, potentially to assert American power where it really matters, at least from his type of perspective, mm-hmm. or from his type of thinking, which is in like in I think more broadly, kind of just real politic thinking. Because I mean, he's still, you know, his main mission is to contain China, right? This is what he thinks a lot about, and of course, like to in order to achieve though, like the, even this goal. Like with the diminishing American resources, I mean, there should be some thought about how can we do that? Because the policy of Biden, for example, it was clear that this the policy of the era that is already gone, which is like the era of American, one can say, unilateralism, right? Started in
the unipolar moment.
So yeah, started in the 90s, 2000s, when America was, I mean, did not face any constraints in any region of the world. And it could just roll over if it wanted. And that's why, like, for example, for me, the whole Biden policy, there is such a big misalignment between rhetoric and action. I mean, just like, you know, just to give you an example with Ukraine. Again, when like Biden administration basically implying that Ukraine will join NATO, but is afraid to accept it into NATO, is because they lack capacity to do so. They lack the power, right? They lack, and only they're afraid of consequences, obviously, because of the war. So instead of just reformulating it like Trump is doing, saying, okay, it's not our interest at all, let's just like agree with the simple reality that we won't accept it to NATO. So, I mean, and this is how I at least think about Trump. I mean, I know it's like, you know, Trump is a very kind of polarizing figure. But when it comes to foreign policy, I think his like perspective is just driven by real politic thinking. I think it's mostly, especially on those issues, because and Trump is not the person who, of course, deeply understands those issues. I mean, he has probably kind of ideas, but people who probably around him, they drive it towards like this perspective of, again, real politic thinking, you know, cutting resources where, you know, they can in order to kind of
focus on a certain objective. I do agree with the idea that the decline was already in motion before Trump came into office. But I think I'll reformulate what I said slightly. He's accelerating the decline.
Right.
And in terms of him being a realist thinker, I mean, clearly, yeah, I mean, if traditional realism, states are all unitary entities that follow their own interests. Strength is the real side of the international system is anarchy and so on and so forth. But I mean, when you look at, you know, his trade war with Canada, it's like, oh, you know, 25% tariffs now. Oh, actually, you know, we'll temporarily give you a break and then let me pressure you into something else. I mean, this is something that is not sustainable in having bilateral relations with a country because, you know, countries have their own, you know, interests and think brains. They're going to think this through. What countries are going to do is they're going to start hedging their bets when they deal with the U.S. Mm-hmm. They're not going to. The trust is irrevocably damaged. I mean, Carney said himself, you know, the leader of the Liberal Party in Canada, that, you know, the U.S. relationship, our relationship with the U.S. will never be what it was. It's changed irrevocably.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's going to be a price to that. I mean, I don't expect nations to back us up, or at least some in the West, to back us up like they used to. And
I don't think I can agree just because it's not like that Canada can. I mean, of course, it has some, you know, bargaining chip with like the US in terms of maybe like oil or gas. But it's not like Canada has any capacity to impact American behavior just because of like the asymmetry.
I mean, I think they can impact the lives of some Americans. I mean, because when you're talking about North America, mm-hmm. it's the most integrated trading bloc in the world.
All right.
Or at least tied with the EU in terms of how integrated. So now to enter a new era, I mean, you know, a lot of cars are produced in Canada as well, or parts for cars mm-hmm. and so on. I mean, this would involve price hikes. I mean, if he really continues to go through with all these tariffs, which, you know, is going to hurt Americans' pockets. And then, you know, it kind of aligns a little bit, again, talking about the war in Ukraine, where, okay, country's going to see, okay, if you got the strength, you can do what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, you could just say, I mean, okay, this is what the world is. This is reality coming to the fold. Multilateralism was always a dream, but I... And then, of course, his plans for Gaza as well. It's...
Yeah.
He hasn't actually taken any firm steps because, I mean, Trump, I don't really think is particularly good at drawing up a plan in itself. The administration as a whole, I don't think they're very good at drawing up clear plans. I see a lot of impulsiveness, a lack of discipline from the administration. So we'll see how much they're actually able to get done. But it's pretty concerning. I mean, now we seem to be getting closer with authoritarian regimes in Central America. I mean, think about El Salvador. But, you know, it does make sense. I mean, Trump himself wants to be a strong man at the very least. He has disdain for checks on his power. Mm. You know, the judiciary openly attacks judges. He tried to overthrow one election. You see that the new spending bill that passed through the Congress, it now gives the president more discretion on spending. Mm-hmm. And I mean, now you see what really, I mean, it could turn into a bit of a, you know, a constitutional crisis. You know, in school in the U.S. we're taught, you know, Congress has the power of the purse. They control, for the most part, spending, how money is spent in the U.S. But Trump and the person who's now in charge of the budget doesn't believe that. Believes that the executive has the unilateral power to spend money on a certain issue or to not, even if Congress approved it. Mm. So again, you see an expansion of the power in the executive. And yeah, I mean, he seems to really identify with a lot of strongmen. I mean, he's openly praised Orban and so
on. Right. So, I mean, that is the case. I mean, that's certain. But I don't know how to... I don't think that much about the Trump, of course, from the perspective of American politics, like internal politics, because I guess there's just a lot.
Yeah, but I'm of the strong, but and yeah, I understand that. I mean, you know, we can't expect to be an expert on every country, but I am very strongly of the belief that in order to understand a country's foreign policy, you have to pay attention to the domestic politics as well.
Right.
It's an important aspect. Of course, what's happening in the rest of the world is very important as well. I mean, it's all holistic, but the domestic politics play a part. And then what I would like to add as well is, I mean, when we talk about China, I don't think you can neatly separate the issue of deterring China and Taiwan and deterring Russia and Ukraine. Because China's watching and they see, okay, after a certain amount of time, the U.S. will, I mean, they can lose will.
But what is like Trump's stance on Taiwan? I think he's not really that...
I don't know if he's actively come out and said, hey, we're going to defend Taiwan militarily.
He has not.
Biden said that on one occasion. I mean, I think historically the U.S. policy is like, we're not going to say that overtly, but that's probably our policy in practice. But now, it's not immediately clear. I mean, that's also going to his administration. It seems like some people really want to do that pivot to China that Obama originally started talking about in the early 2010s, and then some kind of more have an isolationist view where we have a huge ocean on both sides of us. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really matter. It's not really our concern. So,
I mean, it's definitely their concern to preserve American power in the region. I don't know to what extent, like, defending Taiwan, of course, defending Taiwan if, like, you know, in the scenario, if the war happens, to what extent, like, defending Taiwan, I mean, will be American interest, because it will lead to, I mean, obviously devastating war with, you know, two biggest economies. And, you know, probably maybe he thinks about, you know, giving Taiwan to China if there is some type of opportunity to do so in a peaceful manner. Because, I mean, the hypocrisy is also there from the American side, not going to lie, because, I mean, they don't recognize Taiwan as a separate country.
Yeah.
It's also a geopolitical game.
Yeah, because, you know, it's strategic ambiguity. They want to keep you. It's part of kind of an agreement with China, I guess, so to say.
But, of course, it, like, comes down to, like, semiconductor industry. And, I mean, of course, there is also a key American strategic interest in keeping Taiwan out of hands of China. And of course, it's so much harder to invade it, obviously, for obvious reasons, because it's an island. So, but China is also probably not, you know, waiting around. They're probably preparing something.
Yeah, I mean, he continually talks about it. We'll see when you know, when or if China actually makes a move. But yeah, I just want to say that I think there's some level of connectedness between these two issues. But yeah, going back to the broadly what I see with the Trump administration, it's I think it's somewhat self-destructive. I mean, it's almost a little unserious. I mean, some of the ways that they conduct themselves. You know, you got Elon in the Oval Office with his sword on his shoulders answering questions, and he wasn't even elected to any office.
I think it's complete reformulation. I mean, it's complete reformulation of politics as a, you know, as an art and as like a practice. Because obviously, like the things that are happening, they kind of like completely changing how people do politics.
Yeah, my perception of Trump, it's... He almost replaces, to an extent, he replaces substantive politics with theater.
He also has like a real ambition to change something. I guess you cannot really take.
Yeah, he's a political arsonist. He wants to tear down a lot of the institutions, I think, both domestically and internationally. Domestically, a lot of that has to do with checks on his power, and internationally, I guess these multilateral institutions and these agreements that he feels just ties him down. And it's ironic, you know, coming from me, because I would definitely, overall, my politics are pretty progressive, leftist. Overall, those generally are my opinions. But in this sense, you know, sometimes when I think about Trump, I realize, okay, I got some conservatism in me. Because when you think about conservatism, it's a tradition and a respect for, and having value for existing institutions and traditions. And I believe in the value of an international institution like the World Health Organization and the UN. I mean, he's not talking about leaving the UN, so maybe I'll back up a little bit, but let's take the World Health Organization and our checks and balances, you know, our Congress and our judiciary, our journalism as an institution, universities as a counter-majoritarian institution. And again, he really wants to snuff these out when they don't do what he wants. So in that way, actually, it's kind of, you know, funny because obviously he's coming in from the Republican Party, but he's not really even a true conservative.
No, he's a revolutionary.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I don't think a lot of people really understand that, you know.
Yeah, because, I mean, a lot of people, they're accustomed to think through this black and white thinking, and they always try to put everything in a certain basket or category. And of course, Trump itself is a revolution. He changes everything, like from so many things, like how people perceive politics, do politics.
Yeah, I mean, an anti-constitutional revolutionist. Yeah. I mean, he has total disdain for it, I think.
Also, how he works with just media and just like information. It's so unique. And of course, I think he kind of lays foundation for how people will probably work with politics in the future, all type of politicians that are coming, that are probably not completely, I would say, separate from the like elitist institution production, because that's what Trump is. He's basically like anti-system person who got to the most important position in the country that, I mean, if anything, is really well known for having like this tradition of like this traditional caste of people who are like, you know, politicians, like, you know, in a true sense of the word, because they've been doing politics like Biden since, I don't know, teenage years, you know. So this is who Trump is. From my observational perspective, I think this is just he shows how really politics in the age of media, how people will do politics, because now everyone can become a politician. Suddenly you don't even need to have like a strong foundation of ideas, belief systems. Now you just need to have like a good following, be very provocative. You can be caught on being a liar, hypocrite. It doesn't really matter until you gain attention. Until you generate attention, you're ready to go, which is, well, basically he, like how he became president. I mean, because everyone knows he lies.
But yeah, he doesn't even try to keep his lies consistent.
So yeah. I think it tells a lot about maybe society as well, because, you know, that's how people, because I think there is a certain certain trend in society that the way we perceive information, it's we have like this very short span of attention, right? We are unable to really retain information long term, and then we act upon basic information that we see available at the moment, because of, again, the just massive amount of information and stimulus that we get.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think this is an interesting segue though, to this idea that, gotta shout out Vlad Voxer again, just an idea I find interesting in terms of talking about how someone like Trump comes into office in this run of authoritarian populists that we see. Well, first off, I actually do want to say, I think Trump, he clearly is a narcissist. I think the fact that he got elected is an indication of a sick society, because he has psychological issues.
Yeah,
to me, he's clearly a narcissist. It's quite... Am I totally on medical opinion?
I think we are all narcissists. But of course, he's like a case that is...
Yeah, this is why I wish we had someone who studies psychology sitting next to us. But my understanding is someone might have certain signs of narcissism in them. But then there's being an actual narcissist, reaching the actual condition to be, okay, this person is a narcissist. I mean, you know, he to the slightest criticism, he almost throws like tantrums. You know,
I
remember on 60 Minutes, you know, they were pressing him about something, you know, and he just stops the interview halfway and is, I'm done, you're fake news, this and that. I've never seen him really take accountability for any kind of mistake that he's made and so on.
Yeah.
What I wanted to get to is, you know, I want to throw this idea off you in terms of that that Trump voters aren't just stupid or irrational or all racist and so on, but that there's a series of social and economic forces that are pushing people to be more inclined to vote for someone like a Trump, these post-truth authoritarian populists. Mm-hmm. And I mean, some of the ones that I think are interesting is, again, some of these words are straight from Vlad Voxer, but just the idea that social bonds between people are fraying. People are increasingly isolated with each other. And, you know, for me, at least when I'm reading, I see that loneliness is spiking, especially amongst young people.
Right.
But I believe in general, you know, ironically, even though with all this technology we have, I think people are increasingly lonely. I think that, and then also think about certain institutions that acted as social venues. People are less religious than they used to be.
Right.
You know, the church historically is a place for a lot of people to get to know each other and form groups and so on. I mean, I think about the civil rights movement in the U.S., the Black church played a huge role in that. The Muslim mosque as well. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, not the civil rights. Shout out Malcolm X and them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even no fan of the Nation of Islam, to be clear, but shout out Malcolm, got to say that. But then also you have massive inequality as well. And it's getting worse, particularly if you look in the last 30 to 40 years in terms of the proportion of income that goes to the 1% versus the rest of the population. I wanted to throw this idea off you. I mean, do you find that credible? Do you think there's something to that? Do you think that's totally off base? Because, I mean, I think when sometimes people try to make the jump from the psychological to the political, it's a jump too far. But I think the jump can be made at some times. And I think he's onto something here.
You mean, do I find compelling the idea that he's like a symptom of bigger problems in society?
Yeah, because the way I see Trump, right, he is a cause of our democratic decline, but he's also a symptom, and he's much more a symptom than the cause. And this is a quote from Hannah Arendt, I believe, author of Origins of Totalitarianism. And I believe there's a quote, I still actually want to read the book, but it's a quote I saw in an article, that when people... I'm paraphrasing, but basically when people enter a world of alternate reality, and personally I would say that's what happens when you enter the Trump world.
Right.
You know, these lies are not, at 1 minute Zelensky's a dictator, the next week, oh, did I say that? Oh, they're eating the cats and dogs. Yeah. I won the election, it's rigged. Mm-hmm. And going back to the quote is, when people choose to enter a world of alternate reality, it's a verdict against the world that they actually live in.
Mm-hmm.
So the point being, the way I interpret the quote is, there is something really wrong with the world that we're living in right now.
Mm-hmm.
And some people's reaction that they've chosen to take this world is to exit it. And here you have a politician who's willing to fully indulge that.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's something there.
Right. I mean, I definitely think he is a symptom. And also just the amount of change, just the amount of changes that, you know, like we introduced as a society, as states, you know, recently, in recent 20 years, it's so like, it's so shocking, to be honest. And of course, now I feel like the amount of anxiousness and anxiety in the world is out of charts.
Yeah, I believe there's statistics backing up that. I believe maybe we'll do a double check after we do this, but that especially young people, the rate of psychological disorders is going up beyond even ADHD, but including more. So, and I mean, you could talk, okay, what's is just that young people are more self-aware and they're willing to talk about it compared to the older generation, or, you know, maybe it's some of that, but also the phones. Mm-hmm. Also just, you know, the cost of living crisis that we're living in, that some politicians, I mean, you know, it's not even really an urgent topic in American politics.
Right.
I mean, from Trump it wasn't, and Kamala, I mean, it was discussed, but the amount of urgency that I'd like to see addressed to it, I don't see from the Democrat. I mean, definitely not from Trump and them, I mean. That's obvious. But the Democrats as a whole, I mean, I see Bernie talking about it. I see maybe AOC even, but the party as a whole, especially the most powerful people in the party.
Yeah.
It's one of many issues.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel just with all those changes, people lost what, you know, one can call certain foundation. It's like, what's the grounding reality? Like, what is the basis, like the grounding reality that you're not willing to change? So to speak, because we change like basically everything. And I mean, I don't know whether you into like, there is a lot of let's say academic, like the study of modernity itself, just this idea of modernism as this, the process of constant change. And I think what you probably describing, I can also describe it, or at least try to kind of like make an observation from your description that is kind of like the end of this modernity, because we are definitely entering some territory where we just lose the sense where we're going. You know
what I mean? Yeah, yeah. I think because like, there's not much of a vision for the future.
There is none. There's like, and like, it's more, it gets even scarier because there is none. And of course, like the change is accelerating. Like, and we also, again, coming back to the question of diplomacy, we lose the sense of how to communicate to other people, how to communicate to different people, because we all kind of so much spend so much time in our own bubbles and we don't go and talk to people who have different, maybe opposing even ideas. So we completely lose sense of how to actually communicate and build bridges between, you know, like civilizations, communities, what have you. And you can see it in the US, obviously, because there is no real bridge between Democrats and Republicans. Mm-hmm. And you can see it in the world. There is no real bridge between Russia and the US. I mean, now it's like, world is changing. But, and this is, of course, I feel it's all the symptom of this constant, I would say even violent, the process of like the violent process of like the violent changes that are happening in the world. I don't know whether it resonates with you, but I think like it kind of like touches the similar
topic. Yeah, of what I'm talking about in terms of there being social forces behind this. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, and that people feel very dislocated from each other,
right?
And so on. Yeah, I mean, I think there's something to that as well, and
of course there is no vision. And even if you know, go to the question of AI, it's like people with like who like develop those technologies, and they kind of have a vision, but what is this vision? They cannot really put it into coherent picture. Mm-hmm. They just like basically keep on introducing those, and because of the capitalism, because of the incentives.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of money to be made.
Keep on introducing those things, but they completely like shatter like the previous social norms, and then they go create new ones. With the new problems that come with them, but we don't even understand how to
deal with these addresses. And no one's coming to help us. Yeah. No one's coming to help us.
I mean, and then of course it comes to the, again, just to, it just goes, it's just an important question to address, of course. You know, it's very philosophical and very.
Yeah. And then, I mean, you know, if you're talking about the US, if we're going to keep to the US context, I mean, most of these politicians are pretty out of touch, I would say, with the average life of an average person. I mean, because you just have to think about how expensive it is to run for office. I mean, we're talking millions of dollars when you get into the Senate and then the presidency. I believe the house, even it's maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars you need to run. So, which is why, I mean, unless you're already rich, you need to accept donations. And with donations come strings. And, you know, of course, once these people get into office, a lot of them make money, you know, one way or another. And so, yeah, I think these people, maybe a part of the reason they, you know, someone like a Kamala, who personally, I don't think she's a bad person. I mean, I voted for her, full disclosure, even though I was very dissatisfied with a lot of her decisions. But compared to Trump, for me, it was an easy decision. But what I'm saying is, you know, in terms of, you know, her not having the urgency that I would like to see on the topic of the cost of living crisis, housing, she had a plan to build affordable housing, but it wasn't what I personally wanted to see. And my point is, you know, she's very wealthy, has been wealthy for probably a long period of time.
Right.
And it's like, what does she really know about the struggle that most of these people in this country are, you know, going through? So it's scary times. I mean, it's...
But so, of course, like the question of elites being separate from the ordinary people, I guess, of course, like an ages-long question. It's really hard. I think it's really hard to build any kind of like sustainable politics around large scale entities like empires or like very big states, because again, they come like all those, political organizations, they all thrive because they take something from others, or, you know, they redistribute resources, but it all comes down to the point that, you know, some, like, you have to give something to people who you have actually even no access to. You know what I mean? So, I mean, that's how I told you before, like on the podcast, because for me, the only way to build like a truly democratic society is only on a very local level. It's like this scale.
Yeah, so I mean, are you talking about like ancient Greece, Greek democracy, where it's direct participation?
I mean, not necessarily indirect participation. I don't want to, you know, go and again work in the local district office, but, you know, I would rather go and vote for someone who, like, champions to solve my problems.
Yeah, a representative.
Right.
A representative. Yeah, and yeah, then we get into a republic, and I mean, I think once you get to a certain scale, you don't really have much of a choice but to adapt.
Yeah, I mean, and then, of course, it also comes with, the drawbacks of representative system in general, because these parties, in the US, it's an extreme case when the party has to accumulate so many different issues, so you have no choice but to vote for one party, even though you may disagree on many different issues internally within the party, like being Republican or Democrat doesn't really matter, but you have to, you have no other choice. And of course, it comes to just thinking about, but what would be the ideal, like what would be the future of politics, right? What would be better solution? I think those questions, should think of in university.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the first questions that come to mind is, how can we democratize our economy? Because, you know, I mean, again, you know, I could go on a different tangents, but I mean, I think the U.S. has democratic deficiencies a lot of ways in its voting system in terms of who's allowed to vote. You have a lot of felons in a lot of states who can't vote. And then, you know, how expensive it is to run for office. The system disproportionately represents rural states and therefore Republicans more. Right. But I think one area that's really been neglected is, how can we democratize our economies? I mean, think about a corporation, right? I mean, you have a board of directors at the top, you know, whatever, maybe a dozen guys, 20 guys, I don't know. And they make a series of decisions and everyone else has to follow them. I mean, sure, people from the bottom can give their input, but at the end of the day, these, you know, series of people are going to make the decision that they want to make. And then again, you see how the rising inequality in our society and so on. I mean, I don't have the solution, honestly, but I think that topic is something that needs to be desperately addressed. I mean, I think unions, increasing union participation rate is a start. Because, I mean, if you look at the union participation rate, I believe in the U.S. it's like around 10 or 12%. Mm-hmm. It's at a historical low, actually. Mm-hmm. And there's a few reasons behind that. But I think that's somewhere that really we got to start focusing on and thinking about.
I mean, certainly.
Yeah. But then, you know, then we get into class conflict. And then, you know, there's a whole barrel, you know, a whole can of worms that come with that. And you're going to have the propaganda that comes in. I mean, you got the richest man in the world in the president's ear right now.
Yeah, that's a little bit none.
Not ideal.
Not ideal.
So, yeah. Like I said, unfortunately, I don't know where exactly to go with that, but just throwing that one out there.
I mean, I agree. Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, I think there is a need to think about those issues. And again, for me, during this conversation, we kind of found out that, like, for example, for you, this would be, I mean, as you said, like the future of, you know, democratization and how, like the future of how you can democratize economy. Like for me, it would be how you can think through diplomacy versus, you know, non-diplomacy, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I mean, all those questions, they should be definitely addressed. So I guess we have no other choice so far but to, I guess, think about them.
Mm. Yeah.
Unfortunately.
It's our future.
Or the future of the world. All right, Tyler. I guess it was a nice conversation.
Yeah. Thank you for having me on, like always.
Yeah. Then see each other in the next episode.
Yes, sir.